Spiritual Strategies for the Age of Iron, published in Back to Godhead magazine, August 1980. The freezing wind blasting off the river becomes merciless when funneled between the walls of the city's chartered canyons. The wind hurtles a birdshot of cinder and sleet. It sends trash skimming over the icy pavement and lifts it in sudden, dizzying spirals high up the face of the blank and passive towers. A dull, unending roar, as though the buildings moaned under a drugged sleep, fills the chasms. This most densely crowded city of America is also its most desolate waste, and nothing seems more inhospitable to man than the world where everything is man-made. This is New York, in the grip of an iron winter, in the middle of an iron age. We see now a figure making its way along the bottom of one of the empty, iron-rimmed abysses. Leaning forward into the wind, a cane in his hand, he moves steadfastly on. Look at him closely. The saffron robes of an Indian mendicant priest flap below his overcoat, and his forehead bears the parallel clay lines of the devotee of Krishna. His face has an expression both indomitable and serene, as though he were not really walking this bitter wasteland. And indeed he appears so out of place here that a magnolia tree in full fragrant bloom on these hard and frigid streets would seem no less incongruous. This is Srila Prabhupada in the winter of 1966. He is alone, he has no money, and he is 70 years old. His small figure is dwarfed by the towers and icy reserve, whose stern, impervious faces turn all human effort on the streets below into tableau of defeat. But Srila Prabhupada's effort is not merely human, and the seed he brings with him from another world does indeed incredibly, miraculously take root in this barren and uninviting soil and flourish. Soon hundreds of saffron-robed devotees will blossom out into these streets, their American faces marked with the twin clay lines, and the sound of the Hare Krishna mantra will echo and re-echo against the hard, high walls. We should remind ourselves that what we see is not all there is. We never know what unseen presences hover over some lonely and modest endeavor, nor what invisible efforts cooperate to bring great results from meager beginnings. We believe that in nature no effect exceeds its cause. Why should it be different in other affairs? Chance or luck are merely words to cover our ignorance. Behind Srila Prabhupada's appearance on the alien Manhattan streets stand 5 millennia of planning and effort. The story of it opens one sunrise 50 centuries ago in the Himalayas, where the sage Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasa sits in trance on the bank of the Saraswati. In his meditation, Vyasa sees a future of unrelieved horror unfold before him. He sees Kali Yuga, the age of iron, begin, and bring with it universal deterioration. The decay is so deep-rooted that matter itself diminishes in potency, and all our food progressively decreases in quality as well as quantity. Vyasa sees the effects of chronic malnutrition on generation after generation. He watches it gradually diminish their span of life along with their brain power. No one can escape the progressive drop in intelligence and ability to remember. The harassment of hard times upon an increasingly witless population hastens its moral and spiritual decline. People begin to slaughter animals for food. They become more and more enslaved by drugs. They lose all sexual restraint. These habits further their physical and mental deterioration. Vyasa watches them sink deeper and deeper into sensuality and ignorance. Families break up, and women and children are abandoned. increasingly degraded generations, conceived accidentally in lust and growing up wild, swarm over the earth. Leadership falls into the hands of unprincipled criminals who use their power to loot the people. The world teems with ideologues, mystagogues, fanatics, and spiritual bunko artists who win huge followings among a people dazed by social and moral anarchy. Unspeakable depravities and atrocities flourish under a rhetoric of high ideals. Vyas sees horror piled upon horror. He sees the end of everything human. He sees the gathering darkness engulf the world. This is Vyasa's prophetic vision on the eve of Kali Yuga 5,000 years ago. It spurs him into action. For Vyasa's appearance on the brink of this temporal decline is not fortuitous. Vyasa is an avatar, the empowered literary incarnation of God, sent by Krishna specifically to prepare the knowledge of Vedic civilization for transmission through the coming millennia of darkness. Without such an undertaking, the erosion of human intelligence by the force of time would ensure that all future generations would be completely cut off from their own cultural heritage and the matchless spiritual attainment of their forebears. Once the Iron Age begins, they would not even realize that at one time the whole world had been governed by a single, supremely enlightened civilization, the Vedic culture. In that Vedic culture, everything was organized to further self-realization. Self-realization marks the ultimate development of human potential, in which a person knows himself directly as an eternal spiritual being, infrangibly bound to the supreme spiritual being, and without intrinsic relation to a temporarily inhabited material body. By cultivating self-realization, the Vedic civilization brought off this unparalleled achievement. It was able to eliminate completely the evils of birth, old age, disease, and death, securing for its members an eternal existence of knowledge and ever-increasing bliss. The Vedic culture recognized that not all souls who took human birth after transmigrating up through the animal forms would be able to make direct progress toward the supreme goal. Owing to different histories, people are born with different qualities and abilities. Nevertheless, Vedic culture enabled everyone to make some advancement, and there were many arrangements for the gradual elevation of materialistic people. In any case, Vedic culture organized life so that everyone could satisfy the basic necessities in the simplest and most sensible way, leaving most of human energy free for the higher task. Vyasa saw that all this would disappear in Kali Yuga, since the focus of civilization would shift from self-realization to sense gratification. Yet, even though Kali Yuga could not be stopped, he would be able to mitigate its effects and keep alive the tradition of spiritual culture in the way that emissaries of a higher civilization can preserve their heritage among barbarians, or that a well-provisioned village can survive a raging winter. Vyasa was master of all knowledge of Vedic culture, social, scientific, economic, political, ethical, aesthetic, and spiritual. This knowledge was contained in a single, comprehensive canon called the Veda, a word that means simply knowledge. Until the time of Vyasa, the Veda was not written, because writing had been unnecessary. Far from being a sign of intellectual advancement, the appearance of writing as a testimony of decline, a device seized upon to compensate for the mental deterioration which includes the loss of the ability to remember. It is interesting, by the way, that the Vedic date assigned to the advent of Kali Yuga, about 3000 BC, corresponds closely to the date set by modern historians for the rise of civilized life, an event signaled by the appearance of literacy and the emergence of complex urban societies. All that historians recognize as recorded human history is, in fact, only human history in Kali Yuga. The academic historian's ignorance of the earlier and incalculably higher Vedic civilization is what we have to expect from people suffering from the mental retardation imposed by the times. We see symptoms of this intellectual degradation of modern thinkers in their avowal that sense perception is the only source of knowledge, and in their obliviousness to the dependence of knowledge upon goodness. Inverted values warp their ideas, such as the conviction that human progress resides in the proliferation of complex urban societies and increasingly sophisticated technology. They are unaware that simple living is the best basis for high thinking, and that a truly advanced civilization minimizes exploitation of nature and social complexity. They do not know that the real standard of progress is the caliber of people society produces. If we pursue material advancement at the expense of self-realization, measuring our standard of living only by the gratification of our senses, then we will only get a spiritually and morally debilitated people in control of an intricate and powerful technology, a terrifying combination that leads to horrors on a scale we are just beginning to experience. To give us access to an alternative, Vyas divided the Veda into four and wrote it down. Yet he knew that we would still be unable to understand the Vedas, and so he composed a number of supplementary works in which he spelled out the intentions of Vedic thought explicitly. In this, Vyas was aided by Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. Acting in tandem with Vyas's effort, Krishna had descended personally onto this planet, and as a member of the royal order, had played a significant role in recent political events. Vyas took advantage of Krishna's activities and chronicled those times in a vast epic narrative called the Mahabharata. In this sprawling dynastic tale of love, ambition, intrigue, and war, of fidelity and treachery, heroism and cowardice, transcendence and ignominy, Vyas imparted Vedic thought in a way even unphilosophical people would find engrossing. Krishna's presence surcharged history with transcendental significance. Moreover, in the middle of the sweeping narrative, like a jewel placed in a gorgeous setting, Vyasa set the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's discourse to Arjuna before the climactic battle at Kurukshetra. In a laconic 700 verses, Krishna gives Arjuna what he calls the most confidential knowledge of the Vedas. Like Vyasa, Krishna himself is preparing Vedic knowledge for Kali Yuga. This entails taking the highest knowledge of the Vedas, so sublime and pure that, as Krishna says, even great souls rarely attain it, and laying it out explicitly, openly, available to everyone. So that there would be no question about the validity of this daring exposition, Krishna, the highest possible authority, delivers it himself. You may question why the most advanced knowledge in the Vedas is confidential. If it is so important for us to know, then why is it hidden in the first place? The answer is that knowledge is available only to those qualified to apprehend it. Education is progressive, and higher knowledge can be approached only by graduates from the lower. In particular, the qualification necessary to comprehend the mysteries concerning the ultimate source of everything is purity. Only those whose senses are under complete control and who are free from all material desires have the requisite purity to understand and directly perceive the absolute truth. Because people are characterized by a variety of material desires, the Vedas offer many religious paths called dharmas. These are gradated so that people in different statuses of material contamination can ascend step by step to higher states of purity and correspondingly higher disclosures of the divine. In the Gita, Krishna systematically surveys the major Vedic dharmas and shows how each directs a person toward the ultimate conclusion, that most confidential of all knowledge. Krishna analyzes the performance of sacrifices and the worship of demigods. He discusses the yogas of work, meditation, and knowledge. In each case, Krishna shows how it leads to the most secret of all secrets, pure, loving, devotional service to God. Always think of me and become my devotee. Worship me and offer your homage unto me. This, Krishna says, is the most confidential part of knowledge. Since all the Vedic dharmas lead to this one supreme secret, Krishna can offer us this final instruction. Just abandon all varieties of dharmas and surrender to me. In other words, we need not bother with any of the different paths. We can at once come to their common goal, surrender to Krishna. But if this supreme end is so difficult to reach, requiring the ultimate in purity, how is Krishna able to offer it directly to everyone? The answer is simple. Krishna says that if one begins devotional service, he will personally purify the devotee. To those who are constantly devoted and who worship me with love, Krishna says, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. A person can circumvent all the Vedic dharmas and come directly to Krishna because Krishna will kindly help him. This is an extremely important point. As Kali Yuga progresses, all the dharmas become increasingly difficult to pursue. Our intelligence, our memory, and our stamina have all decreased. But Krishna is willing to compensate for all our infirmities by his personal effort. By opening up, through divine kindness, direct devotional service, the Bhagavad Gita, in effect, renders every other Vedic dharma obsolete. Vyasa made this message the centerpiece of the Mahabharata. Vyasa also expanded upon the Vedic teachings in 18 Puranas, and he compiled an outline of the philosophical conclusions of the Vedas in the Vedanta Sutra, a collection of extremely compressed, aphoristic utterances. Later thinkers would present their understanding of Vedic thought in the form of commentaries on these sutras. After Vyas completed his immense labor, he was surprised to find himself dissatisfied. As he reviewed his efforts to discover what deficiency could be at the root of his discontent, his guru, Narada Muni, arrived at his ashram. Vyas placed the matter before Narada. Narada praised Vyasa's brilliant work, but then told him that his labor was still incomplete. In the Mahabharata and the Puranas, Narada said, Vyasa had not sufficiently described the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna. In faithfully transcribing the Vedic teachings, Vyasa had dutifully set forth all those materially motivated dharmas, those teachings which allow restricted sense gratification for people who cannot come directly to the higher level of realization. In Kali Yuga, such dharmas will become especially dangerous, Narada warned, because people will seize upon such allowances to sanction indulgence. They will accept such activities in the name of religion, Narada said, and will hardly care for prohibitions. Narada wanted Vyas to describe more completely the transcendental qualities and activities of Krishna, because he said by hearing them, people would be able to relish their extraordinary spiritual flavor. People's natural attraction to the Lord would be revived, and, as a matter of course, they would lose their taste for mundane pleasures. Narada counseled Vyasa about the spiritual potencies of words that glorify Krishna. When spoken in pure devotion, those words enter into the hearts of the listeners and destroy almost completely the impurities of passion and ignorance. With Narada's blessings, Vyasa then completed his masterpiece, The Ripened Fruit of the Tree of Vedic Knowledge, Srimad Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam picks up where the Gita leaves off, for Vyasa explicitly states that it is intended for those who have already abandoned materially motivated dharmas. Here Vyasa discloses the inviolable mysteries of the personal life of the Supreme Lord Krishna, his eternal loving affairs with his most confidential and intimate devotees. Here we have spiritual life revealed at its most intense and personal, at the absolute summit of love of God. We see from the cooperative efforts of Krishna and Vyasa at the beginning of Kali Yuga that there was a move to make the esoteric knowledge of the Vedas, the highest truths concerning the nature of God and our relation to Him, open and potentially available to everyone. This unprecedented disclosure had its dangers, and neither Krishna nor Vyasa could circumvent the stricture that these confidential truths could be understood only by those utterly pure in heart. In spite of the degradation of Kali Yuga, the requirement for purity must stand. What they did was make available a correspondingly more powerful process of purification. In the Gita, Krishna offers personally to help anyone sincerely engaged in devotional service. And in the Bhagavatam, Vyasa offers the most potent of all purifying processes, the chanting and hearing of the glories of Krishna himself. Vyasa and Krishna completed their activity, and with the disappearance of Krishna from the earth, Kali Yuga set firmly in. The ensuing degeneration was so strong, however, that in a short time it threatened to destroy all Vyasa's efforts to preserve Vedic culture. The words of Narada, "They will hardly care for your prohibitions," proved horribly accurate. A particular perversion arose, which was so dangerous that Krishna had to take emergency measures. This is what happened. A few thousand years after the onset of Kali Yuga, the followers of the Vedas, now restricted geographically to India, began more and more to slaughter animals for food. Meat-eating is so polluting to human consciousness that indulgence in it makes any sort of spiritual realization virtually impossible. Therefore, the Vedas had always instructed against it. At the same time, it was recognized that some people, in spite of all prohibitions, will eat flesh anyway. Accordingly, for them the Vedas enjoin that if someone wants to eat flesh, he may sacrifice a goat, no other animal, on the night of the dark moon, no other time, to the goddess Kali. The sacrificer, furthermore, must whisper in the goat's ear a mantra that says, "I am killing you now, but in my next life you will have the opportunity to kill me." By sanctioning meat-eating in this way, the Vedic culture at least kept it under control. Only a goat, only once a month, and only in the unpleasant consciousness of its karmic price, all very discouraging conditions. However, as the Brahmanas, the Vedic priests in Kali Yuga, became degraded, they began to proliferate animal sacrifices to meet popular demand by explaining away or ignoring the restrictions. Temples were transmogrified into slaughterhouses, and killing as an organized daily business flourished. If anyone objected to this unprecedented evil, the priest would reply that it was, after all, sanctioned in the Vedas. Therefore, to stop the animal killing, Krishna descended as Lord Buddha, about 500 BC. Because the Vedas were being perversely used to justify the slaughter, Krishna, as Lord Buddha, denied the authority of the Vedas, the same Vedas he had so carefully arranged and explicated to save the people in Kali Yuga. But it was an emergency. There was no alternative. Lord Buddha rejected the Vedas and preached the ethic of ahimsa, or non-injury, to all living beings. The Buddha also taught that our material existence is suffering, that our material desires cause our suffering, and that by extirpating these desires we can attain nirvana, release from material existence. Lord Buddha refused to deal with any question concerning God, the soul, life after salvation, and so on. When asked about such things, he would reply, "The Tathagata, the Buddha, is free from all theories." Later, some of his followers spread the doctrine of shunya, voidism, and anatma, no soul, but these were mundane interpretations of the Buddha's silence on transcendental topics. The simple fact is that Buddha had denied the Vedas, yet he remained faithful to them by refusing to make theories, that is, to discuss God or the soul, independently of the Vedic teachings. So he said nothing. Their consciousness polluted by meat-eating, the people had become atheists. But Lord Buddha, who never said anything about God, won their devotion. Thus Krishna tricked the atheists into worshipping him in his incarnation as the Buddha. Lord Buddha's mission was successful. All of India eventually took up his teachings, and animal slaughter ceased. Lord Buddha exemplifies the transcendental cleverness of Krishna. Yet, while Lord Buddha's success averted the immediate danger, it left India without respect for the Vedas and in the grip of a philosophy that denied God and the soul. The Buddha's palliative was incomplete. It was only a first step toward a complete Vedic restoration. Krishna's next move was to send an incarnation of Lord Shiva to execute the second step. This was Sripad Shankaracharya, who appeared in AD 788. In a life of only 32 years, Shankara drove the Buddhists out of India and re-established the authority of the Vedas. A member of the renounced order, a sannyasi, Shankara was a thinker of immense power, and he dedicated his formidable ability to persuading the followers of Buddhism to accept the Vedas. To do this effectively, Shankara had to make the transition between the two easy. So he devised a philosophy called Advaita Vedanta, or absolute non-dualism, a kind of crypto-Buddhism that he ingeniously expounded in Vedic language and supported with Vedic texts. Shankara denied the Buddhist doctrine that the ultimate truth is void. The truth, Shankara argued, as the Vedas declare, is Brahman, spirit. Shankara likewise confuted the Buddhist doctrine of no soul or self, and re-established the Vedic truth of the Atma, the individual soul. However, Shankara asserted the identity of Atma and Brahman as an undifferentiated spiritual reality without any qualities, varieties, or relations. Obviously, there is no cognitive difference between void and Brahman without qualities or distinctions. Shankara's Brahman is an intellectual clone of the Buddhist void. Thus Shankara eased the way for acceptance of the Vedas. Shankara's philosophy of impersonal oneness has some basis in the Vedas. For neophyte spiritualists, whose residual material contamination prevents them from understanding the transcendental nature of Krishna, the Vedas gave instruction for salvation by merging into the impersonal Brahman, Krishna's spiritual effulgence. Associated with those instructions are texts that emphasize the qualitative oneness of Atma and Brahman. The Vedas contain other equally important texts that say that the Atmas are numerically distinct and quantitatively different from the supreme Atma, Krishna. But Shankara stressed the oneness. He presented transcendent reality in an abstract form, and so made the Vedas palatable to the Buddhists. Shankara restored Vedic culture. He founded monasteries, organized the Brahminical community, and re-established the worship of Vedic deities. The Vedas were recognized again, although necessarily in a distorted fashion. Buddhism is an advancement over gross materialism, and impersonal monism over Buddhism. But the personal theism of the Vedas, as set out by Vyas and Krishna, had yet to be restored. After Shankara, that work began. As people returned to Vedic study in earnest, many began to recognize the deficiencies in Shankara's monistic interpretation. Several powerful teachers arose, most notably Ramanuja, 1017 to 1137, and Madhva, 1239 to 1319, whose cogent commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra and the Bhagavad Gita seriously challenged the Shankara hegemony and gained theism a wide following. But the impersonalists retained civic control. Then, about 500 years ago, Krishna descended once again, this time to complete the restoration of Vedic culture. This is Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sri Chaitanya is Krishna in the guise of his own devotee, teaching by his example the supreme form of worship. Chaitanya's mission had two sides. On the one, he even more fully disclosed the nature of the highest love between Krishna and his most intimate devotees, and Chaitanya was continually merged in the ecstasy of that love. On the other side, Chaitanya accompanied this revelation with a correspondingly more powerful means of God realization, the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. This mantra is part of the original Vedas, but because it was chanted by Sri Chaitanya, its power increased multifold, and Chaitanya taught his followers the practices by which the power of the mantra could work unimpeded. With Chaitanya, the trend of delivering progressively more open disclosures of the Vedic secrets, along with a correspondingly more powerful means to realize them, reached its culmination. A more potent means of deliverance naturally entails the spiritual enfranchisement of greater numbers of people. Krishna had already declared in the Gita that people traditionally excluded from spiritual realization, women, merchants, and laborers, could, by taking shelter of him, approach the supreme destination. And in the Bhagavatam, Vyas had asserted that even members of carnivorous and aboriginal communities, completely beyond the pale of spiritual culture, could be purified by the association of a pure devotee of Krishna. Sri Chaitanya demonstrated in practice that this is so. As the most merciful of all avatars, Chaitanya initiated a spiritual democracy, and by the power of his chanting he turned people of vile habits into pure devotees. The Brahmanas claimed exclusive right to spiritual knowledge, but Chaitanya showed that the potency of devotional service could elevate even the most base-born to the Brahminical platform. Chaitanya recognized everyone as a candidate for devotional service, and he wanted his movement of congregational chanting to be spread over the globe. One day, he said, my names will be chanted in every town and village in the world. Chaitanya also delivered the most comprehensive understanding of Vedic theism. He confronted, in person, the two greatest impersonalists of his time, Prakashananda Saraswati and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, and presented such a powerful theistic exposition of the Vedanta Sutra that both acknowledged devotion to Krishna to be the goal of the Vedas, and they danced and chanted with Chaitanya. All the work of Krishna, Vyas, Buddha, and Shankara to establish Vedic culture in Kali Yuga reaches its fulfillment in the appearance of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. In the original Vedas, the Kali Santarana Upanishad had disclosed, One cannot find a method of religion more sublime in the Kali Yuga than the chanting of Hare Krishna. And looking forward to the coming of Chaitanya, Vyas had recorded in the Bhagavatam, "In the age of Kali, intelligent persons perform congregational chanting to worship the incarnation who constantly sings the name of Krishna. Although his complexion is not blackish, he is Krishna himself. He is accompanied by his associates, servants, weapons, that is the Hare Krishna mantra, and confidential companions. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then, is the long-awaited deliverer of the means of spiritual realization for this age. 10 spiritual masters in succession have passed Sri Chaitanya's teachings down to Srila Prabhupada, and it is only appropriate that we should find him in the winter of 1966, far from his native India, on the wind-racked streets of New York, center of the global technological civilization, heartland of Kali Yuga. It is the best place for him to carry the seed of Vedic culture. It is here that the work of Krishna, Vyas, Buddha, Shankara, and Chaitanya, in the care of their empowered servant Prabhupada, flowers and bears fruit."